dancing in the apocalypse.
I gotta get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and sparkle, Neely, sparkle.
I know what some of your big city no bra wearing hairy legged women livers might say.
Hello everyone and welcome to Maximum Film. It's episode 252 and I'm asking you what it do. It's your host Ify Wadi Wayne in the studio with me virtually are my friends. So let me introduce you to them. First up, we have the Christmas Zaddy himself, according to me, America's favorite critic. It's Alonzo Duralde. What's good?
Oh, gosh, Ify. Happy first day of Christmas in July, by the way. What's good with me is season two of Only Murders in the Building, a show I really, really got into the first time around. And I don't know if it's just like my pandemic scarred psyche or what, but it was genuinely like a reunion with friends I had missed watching those first two episodes as they dropped on Hulu this week. I was like, oh, yeah, these guys, I've missed them. And now you're back. So, I love what this show is doing tonally. I love the comedy. I love how it's kind of ripping on the whole true crime podcaster craze. And at the same time, it's giving us these like genuinely interesting and flawed and vulnerable characters. And Selena Gomez just has one of the great deadpans of this generation. So I don't know, if you're not watching it, you're missing out.
Ooh. You could very ungenerously also deem her deadpan as just, you know, a flat affectation and an inability to line deliver. But I actually do think she's got more. Like, I do think what she brings in balancing out the Steve Martin and Martin Short of it is like very important and interesting.
I choose to believe that would require so much effort and editing that the Occam's razor here is that no, she's actually good and knows what she's doing.
I like that take. Well, that other voice you heard piping in with some piping hot takes is none other than the queen of the Midwest herself, Treya Clark. What's good?
Queen of the Midwest.
Oh, okay. Now that I like that you're now accepted the queendom, yeah. And now you're just going to share it.
I just need people to know that we are legion. Yeah. The timing worked out really well for the movie that we are. But I went to Vegas this past weekend.
Ooh.
But when I say that, it's really that one of my best friends, Marnie, lives right outside Vegas. We did not go to any Vegas things. We hung out at our friends Hannah and Beverly, and we hung out at the house like fun middle-aged ladies do. But it was wonderful, and this is a good friend of mine that I haven't seen since pre-pandemic. And, we did all our tests and then like bunkered down together. But I did get to drive by, waved at the strip. Thought I just imagined Anne Margaret still on it. So yeah, Vegas baby. I did not say not
was
once.
Was there a pool at least? I hope
there wasn't, but there was air conditioning.
I'll take it.
Yeah, you would need to. It was 109 degrees.
I bet Vegas. It was.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been heating up all around, and even right now what I've now learned, my office, I need a fan. I'm going to get a fan in here, but I need one right now. It is cooking, but you know, we're going to keep it cooking. Buckle up because we have Maria Lewis, author and screenwriter, pop culture commentator, returning to the show and joining us all the way from Australia. What's good?
What's good? Thanks so much for having me back. I'm so excited. I wasn't sure if I talked too much about finger banging last time. And I was like, oh, they're never going to invite me back. But here I am, back.
Yeah, that's the number one way to get invited back immediately by me.
Well, you weren't there. You're talking the exact right amount of finger banging. Yeah.
My what's good this week is something, I guess, like I'm trying to look for positives wherever I can find them. But it's a small, wee commercial what's good. And my favorite film is Alien, and I sold the project. And so to celebrate, I bought the Reebok Alien Stompers, which are essentially recreation shoes of what Lieutenant Ellen Ripley wears in the film. And they are so rad. They are so cool. They make me so happy. I just got the high top versions because I feel like practically the ones that go halfway up your calf, I'm just not going to get use for them in everyday life unless I'm like, you know, fighting aliens and xenomorphs in space and stuff. But sure. I am just so thrilled. They are just like, it's a shoe that just makes me so happy. And I'm so glad I dropped the coin. And the box came in this full like Yutani Weyland Corp themed box. Like the detail on the packaging was insane. It just lighted nice. My life sure. right up.
That's what's up.
I did see an ad on my Instagram this week for a Puma X Dunkin' Donuts collab with these pink and orange shoes, and I immediately thought of you. If, I
know if you Ben were, Affleck set up in bed. Take that
particular plunge, but you
yes.
Know. And by the way, what's good, sir?
Oh, what's good with me? Well, you know, I did two things good with me. We're back, you know, in the room, and this time in person, and it's been fun because it's on we're shooting at Universal, you know, it's an NBC Universal show.
Tell people what room it is.
Yeah, the Grand Crew, or what I've been calling Grand Two, because it's season two. We're back. It's going great already, but because we're like actually on the back lot, you see the Universal tram drive by every time. And I remember when I was a kid, I'd be on the back lot and I'd go, those are some Hollywood people doing Hollywood things. And now I am Hollywood people doing Hollywood
That's
things,
right.
Which is drinking too much LaCroix and oversharing about my sex life for fodder for the show. But then, you know, I wave, they wave back. They're like real excited. It's a good time. It was real cool, full circle moment.
Iffy, I mean, what you're describing, do what you love. You'll never work a day in your life.
Also, oversharing about your sex life is your brand, babe. Lean into
it.
Yeah,
exactly. This is true. Lean in.
Oh.
The people that you used to watch on the tram were probably just smoking a lot of cigarettes and, like, you know, spiking their bad coffee with whiskey. So, you know, the cycle continues forward.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm keeping the dreams alive. Keeping it all the way alive. But speaking of dreams, much like the dreams that Elvis had in his protest song, we're going to be talking about Elvis on this pod, where we look into Baz Luhrmann's greatness in its shiny, sparkly glory. And later we'll take a call from the hotline. But first, it's time for Itadic, short for Is This Important? Do I Care? Our movie news segment, where we go through movie news of the week and decide as a group, is it important, and if we care? So Alonzo's going to kick this thing right off.
So it's been a while since we've had actual good news in terms of theatrical box office. So here's a cool change of pace. For the third week in a row, more than one film had strong ticket sales. In fact, this past weekend, four separate films each made more than $20 million domestically. That's the first time that's happened on a non-holiday weekend since 2017. Is this important? Do you care?
Hell yeah. I'm assuming one of those movies was Marcel Duchamp with the shoes on? 20 million?
Probably would have, but it's in limited release. It's expanding. Oh, yeah,
okay. You know? It'll be there next weekend.
Yeah.
This is great. Like, the difference of the emphasis here on the fact that there were four films. I mean, because we've seen your Spider-Mans get, like, a ton of people showing up. And, you know, good for them. But this bodes well for a continued box office resurgence and of people feeling comfortable, whether or not they're being smart in that being comfortable, a whole other game. But in terms of the industry that we all work in, it is good news. And also, I really like thinking of people out there going to the movies, enjoying things. Please find some escapist enjoyment, other humans.
Yeah. It is nice to know that even given a year and a half, 2 years, maybe the people were not feeling safe to do it. It didn't seem like the right thing to do, that they are so hungry to do it again. You know, like, I think there was a legit fear on people's parts that people were going to sort of get out of the habit of going to movies, or realize, oh wow, I could just wait a couple weeks and watch it at home, not to get in my living room and deal with all the parking and the phones and the kids and the blah 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 blah. But no, like, people really do want the full Nicole Kidman, you know, even heartbreak feels good in a place like this. And they're out getting it. So yes, I think given that directly or indirectly, this is the industry that pays our bills. Yes, of course.
Yeah, that was me over the past weekend. I had, tragically, not tragically, but just like stupidly, I broke my elbow and ankle in like one swift move. And so I hadn't been able to leave the house for the third June in a row because where I live, we've been locked down for the past 2 years. But this past weekend, I was able to get out and I was like, to the cinema, baby. I went and saw Maverick. I went and saw Elvis. I went and saw Man. I just like went out and smashed a bunch of movies in a row. And it was so good. I was genuinely the Nicole Kidman, like, heartbreak does feel good in a place like this. I was thrilled. I was like, I'll boost those box office sales. It was just so nice to see something, A, on the big screen, but B, in a shared theatrical environment. And I was just like, I think I might be having a breakdown because I cried twice during Maverick. So I was like, oh no, I'm very unwell.
I cry at everything. This is a safe space for that.
Great. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it does feel good to be back, though. It's a fun ride.
And I'm just going to say, it would behoove you to still wear a mask, even if everyone's telling you don't have to anymore. Because just anecdotally, like many people in my immediate circle seem to be testing positive for the first time after years of avoiding it. So let's just not all gallivant like mad. But yes, I think if you're masked up and you go to the movies and you sit there for a couple hours, you're good.
Yeah.
Shout out to all of my people who are like me discovering the joy of the weekday matinee and the nearly empty theaters that come with that. It's great. We count for box office too, dang it. All right. Hey, speaking of movies. Yeah. Nailed it every time. CAA has acquired ICM for $750 million. If you're wondering what those initials are, they represent two of the major Hollywood agencies who represent actors, writers, directors, and creatives of all kinds, and they're now set to merge into one following a very lengthy Department of Justice looking at, because it truly is getting into kind of
monopoly territory.
Yeah. The firms say that the merger will better position them to compete with rival agency WME, which is William Morris, which merged with Endeavor like 10 years ago now. That was a big deal then. This is a big deal now. And of course, this merger will lead to 105 layoffs, probably to begin with, about a quarter of ICM staff. Is this important? Do you care?
There's a million reasons why I want to say no to this too. I mean, one, you talk about like what was essentially the big three, what used to be the big four, which was CAA, WME, UTA. And then what was the one that was merged before?
Endeavor?
It was Endeavor with William Morris.
Yeah. So like, you know, like a lot of times, like one, those are like the biggest ones that you would hope to get for at some point in your career. But also here's the two major elements that I'm thinking about when this thing happens. One is the major element of when you're not, you know, one Timothy Chalamet or Sam Richardson or, you know, a high grossing movie star. And you're just, you know, a guy who like maybe
solid Sam Richardson comp there.
Yeah, you know.
When you're thinking of major league talent, Sam Richardson. Oh, yeah.
Always a go-to.
Absolutely. I love it.
You can't flip on a streamer without seeing his face at this point. He's getting there. But like, yeah, you those dudes probably have access to their like team and can call them. But when you're smaller on that totem pole, it makes it harder to get in touch because you're kind of just a bullet in the chamber that they're firing at auditions. And I think when you have two large, you know, agencies like this merge, you only get smaller in that larger pond. And then let's not get into like the many ways that, you know, these agencies dip into conflicts of interest by, you know, so that's just seeing, you know, that could be a whole episode talking about that. So
I think if we learned anything from the Apple, it's that one big talent agency running everything is not good for anything.
Yeah, exactly.
I think we learn a lot from the Apple and that is definitely one of them. But on the outside, for everyone listening that didn't know what those initials meant, who knows if this will affect you at all.
But it's also, it's pretty interesting. Probably not. The past like sort of year and a half, I think it's been really interesting because there's been so many mergers like this. Like I keep thinking of the AT&T merger with Warner's. And then that didn't go through. And then so a bunch of people who were fired were brought back on, and lines that were cut, which I had a line that was cut as part of that merger, which then was resurfaced, but then disappears because of the Discovery merger. It's just, it's really crazy the ramifications something like this can have in ways that you don't think might impact a general listener or a general viewer. But the little weird echoes of that really infiltrate down in ways that are, I don't know, very, very interesting and stressful.
This is the sausage. But, you know, if AT&T hadn't devoured or tried to devour Time Warner, Filmstruck might still be around and I would be on it. So, you know, there it all has ramifications.
We're talking about ramifications. Now we're talking about ramming them weights and getting swole. Natalie Portman worked out for 2 hours a day for 10 months for Thor 4. I love how that rhymes. If you saw Natalie Portman's arms in that Thor Love and Thunder trailer and thought, that must be CGI, think again. In a story from Variety, her trainer for the film, Naomi Pendergast, shared that they started working out 5 months before filming started. Portman reported training for 2 hours a day, 5 days a week, continuing through to the filming process, 10 months in all. Is this important? Do you care?
Yes. You want to talk about seeing those guns on screen? You should see those guns in these streets. Like, they were here filming for a really, really long time in Australia. And it was really fascinating having seen her around and being like, wow, I'm not sure if she, because she's very slight. She's a very small woman. And so I was like, am I going mad? She looks pretty buff, you know? And then when like that, the arms, her like Linda Hamilton T2 guns have become a part of the marketing campaign, which I love, but it's also, you know, I was somebody who grew up, I was a professional athlete before I became a writer. And it was this thing where you would look for representation or you'd look for versions of yourself. And I was looking for that both like culturally with Pacifica women, but also looking for thick bitches. And they just, it wasn't out there. Any woman that was strong also had to be tiny. And Natalie Portman is still tiny. And yes, her arms are shredded, but this is the sort of thing that like She-Hulk and Big Barda and Vasquez and those kinds of strong, thick pop cultural women who were visibly, visibly strong, not just like Buffy, for instance, which, you know, you're told is strong and SMG is tiny. That made a huge difference. It really like made me feel seen in a certain way. So I was excited that this has become part of the narrative because, yeah, although she is, you know, has a ballerina body to make a Black Swan reference for all intents and purposes, she did what she could within her capacity to just like add a little bit of junk to the metaphorical arm trunk. And I just sort of wish, I mean, it's difficult because Jane Foster and that version of Thor is who it is and you can't switch it up. And I don't want them to because I think she plays that role great. But it is the kind of thing, I remember when they were casting She-Hulk, I was like, please, please cast somebody swole. I really was just so hopeful, like, please cast someone swole. And I just want to see more swole representation. Like, that would be wonderful.
Oh, yeah. No, we love buffness around here. And I think also what I like is when we talk about, you know, the work that goes into this like that, I think it kind of levels the playing field for, you know, body standards, right? Because, you know, it's very easy to see a Chris Evans and these buff bodies and not know the work that goes into it and that it is a essentially unsustainable thing. Like Natalie Portman was able to bulk up like this because she was being paid and her trainers were being paid and she was on a like strict diet that helped her get that mass. But then I think you're right, you know, and you know, it's been, you know, the sites have been buzzing, you know, that you know, that the push was for a thicker She-Hulk, and I'll leave it all at that on air. But yeah, no, I agree wholeheartedly.
I really like how she phrased this herself. The quote from this Variety story, on Black Swan, I was asked to get as small as possible. Here, I was asked to get as big as possible. And that's an amazing challenge and also a state of mind as a woman. And I think that's so true. Like we've, you know, typically you see fluctuations in male bodies and they're, you know, obviously Christian Bale is kind of the gold standard of that. Like, oh, I'm withered and super skinny, but even he got shredded as the Batman. But then when you have Natalie Portman, her Black Swan thing, it was, I mean, ballerinas are, it's, that's also an impossible body type to bring onto. And it is such a different state of mind to approach something up. I want my arms big. I want to be strong in this way, but that is visible. Cause I think, I mean, there's a, whatever, that's 12 different podcasts about that, but women and arms and muscles, like there's so much built into the fabric of how women consider themselves judged or feel judged. So to have this also be as applauded as it's been, and people who are like seeing that visual of her and psyched and cheering it, and then what that can hopefully tell the younger girls watching it of like, yeah, that's something fun to aim for and to feel celebrated in as a physique. And I love that, and good for her for also acknowledging that it's a mental undertaking as well.
And I think the fact that Natalie Portman basically had walked away from this franchise quite happily, that she's getting to come back on her own terms, and that this is how she wanted to do it and the way she wanted to do it. And it's not like you don't get the impression anybody's going to pressure her about this stuff, because they couldn't. Because she didn't need it. She already was gone. She's like, okay, I'll come back and I'll do this and I'll get myself into this shape and I'll, you know, play the character this way. And that's how we're going to roll here. So, you know, yeah, good on her. And by all means, always good, I think, to mix up the variety of how women in media in general get to be, but even specifically in these MCU movies.
And it's also the connective tissue there is like one of the big draws for her coming back to the franchise was Taika. And what is Taika? He's a Māori man, and Māori culture and Māori women are thick women. We're built strong. We built visibly and physically strong. And it's I don't know. I was just thinking about it a lot when reading her comments about it. It's like, if this is a different filmmaker or a filmmaker who comes from a different background culturally, is that approach and that encouragement of her to get as big as possible, is that colored by something else if it's not a Pacifica man in that position, or it's not a director of color? And I sort of, again, not to get on the Echoes train and Colors of the Wind it, but I genuinely think I was thinking about that a lot, because even the presence of people like Rachel House, who played Topaz in Ragnarok, it's like we don't get to see Pacifica faces in films like this very often. Even Taika, he's playing Korg, that's a CGI generated character. And so getting to have those versions of women represented, I think, is just like vitally important for the whole body dysmorphia conversation, but also just the way women feel about seeing themselves on screen and getting to embrace strength as it appears like visibly and physically.
Ooh, I think that's the perfect note to go out on. So we're going to take a break, but when we come back, can we help falling in love with Elvis? You'll find out. Stay right there.
Hal Lublin here with breaking news on a revolutionary form of entertainment, professional wrestling. For more, we go to our correspondent, Danielle Radford.
Professional wrestling is the craze that's sweeping the nation, featuring fisticuffs and colorful costumes.
But who can help us make sense of this world of body slams? Lindsay Kelk has the answer.
Sources tell us of an amazing podcast called Tights and Fights, filled with discussions of the absurdity of professional wrestling, plus all the sincerity and hilarity that you could shake a stick at.
Listen to the Tights and Fights podcast every week.
Find it on Maximum Fun or wherever you get your podcasts.
And your old-timey radio.
Welcome back to Maximum Film. I'm your host, Ify Wadiwe. In the studio with me are...
Drea Clark.
Maria Lewis.
Alonzo Duralde.
And now, Elvis. Director Baz Luhrmann is known for his maximalist approach to filmmaking. Now he's made a biopic about a larger-than-life star who left behind an over-the-top legend. Alonzo, would you mind giving us a brief synopsis of this 2-hour and 32-minute movie?
Oh, why do I get stuck with these? All right. So our narrator for this is one Colonel Tom Parker, as played by Tom Hanks, in a style that we will definitely be getting into. Looking back on his career as the man who created, managed, and essentially sucked the life out of Elvis Presley. We see him as a kind of a carnival huckster, managing a singer named Hank Snow, and he encounters young Elvis. He sees the sexual frenzy that Elvis generates in the women who watch him swing his hips and realizes, this kid is my meal ticket. And so he begins to take over his career. Makes a star out of him, negotiates the complications of, you know, the police and sort of other cultural watchdogs who object to Elvis because of his raw sexuality and the fact that his music is so much entrenched in the what was then called race music at a time when, you know, segregation was at its most virulent. And, you know, over the course of Elvis's life, we see him fall in love and marry his wife, Priscilla, make a lot of really crappy movies in Hollywood, do the 1968 comeback special, but then eventually just sort of throw away the rest of his years on Vegas and drugs and Colonel Tom. And all of this done in the singular shitting glitter style of Rococo legend Baz Luhrmann. Elvis!
Elvis! You did Elvis. It, Alonzo.
It was definitely a film.
Yes. What did y'all know about Elvis going into this? And what was your impression of him and or his music? And I'm curious from Maria's perspective, because I feel like Elvis is synonymous with Americana.
Mm. Well, you know what's so interesting about that is Australians fucking love Elvis. They froth the guy. It's so wild. The only official Elvis memorial outside of Graceland is actually in Melbourne at Melbourne General Cemetery, which is so weird. And so I ended up working tangentially on this project that was like looking at Australians' obsession with Elvis, because he never toured here. Obviously, it's a part of the film is that he couldn't tour internationally, right? And so it's not like he ever came here and people like caught his panties and were like, oh my God, I got touched by, you know, whatever, Elvis, this is amazing. But for some reason, Australians have always been obsessed with Elvis in a way that is really fascinating and kind of puzzling to me and my generation. So when it was announced that Baz was doing the Elvis movie, in so many ways, it made no sense, but it made so much sense at the same time. Because the definition of Baz is OTT, right? And then tapping into, because it was his generation really that were the Australians who were obsessed with Elvis. So all of these things kind of clicked into place and made sense to one small continent on the other side of the world. To everybody else, I'm sure they're like, why this guy? Why this story? And why this film that gave Tom Hanks bloody corona? Because he caught it while making Elvis on the Gold Coast.
I feel like I'm the only person here who was alive when Elvis died. Like I remember his death. I was like 10 years old and it was a huge deal. It was like, you know, it was big news and in all the papers, and you know, the TV coverage of people flocking to Graceland and like leaving flowers at the gate, and the whole thing of it was just like it was big. And I mean, I grew up in the South, so like they loved Elvis there. I felt like Elvis's shitty movies were always on television. Dave and I were just talking about this. Like, I don't think that either of us have ever seen one start to finish, but we've seen bits of all of them because they were just always on TV in the background throughout our childhood. My father's, you know, he was a doctor at his office. His receptionist was a big Elvis fan and gave me, for one of my birthdays when I was really little and said like a little shitty record player, like a greatest hits album of Elvis. So like, I kind of just feel like he was in the air, you know, he was a big thing. And I think that he marks this kind of fascinating kind of celebrity because, you know, you have like young hot Elvis and then fat bloated Elvis. You have, you know, the idea that he kind of like brought rock and roll to the masses, but then also that he scavenged, you know, R&B and blues and gospel from black people. But then also that, well, of course, they were going to find a white guy who could do all that to sell it to the masses. Not for nothing does, you know, Eminem sing the closing credits song in this movie. so, you know, he is filled with contradictions and craziness. And so, yeah, again, perfect choice to make a movie about him. Baz Luhrmann, who like wouldn't know subtlety if he stepped on it in 10-inch platform heels.
I agree. Like Elvis is he's the Marilyn Monroe, right? Like he's someone who's become iconic and larger than life. And had in this death. Tragic story in death, right? Had this tragic story, but also this like enormous rise, even more so. I mean, his legacy is broader or whatever. But I think that when I was leaving the theater, there was like a teenager and her mom or something. And the teenager said something like, "Oh, I didn't know he used to be hot." And I was like, oh, I hope someone first breaks it to her. This is Austin Butler is playing him. But okay. But the idea that they cast an attractive man like that, because I was like, oh, there's an entire population that only knows sweaty Vegas Elvis, you know? And because that is an equal iconography of him that's gotten. So I think what you know of him, and for me, I also take offense. I love his movies. I loved them as a child. Fast and the Furious has nothing on Viva Las Vegas's insane, absolute.
Oh, that car race, yeah.
The car races that are completely just green screen. Oh, they're so fantastic.
Friend of the show, William Bibbiani, ranked every single Elvis movie for the rap. And he talks about how Viva Las Vegas actually predates the original Speed Racer, but that they seem to be borrowing a lot of the same kind of camera techniques.
But Viva Las Vegas, actually, speaking, just to bring it back to this movie, I was enamored as a producer. I was like, oh my God, there is like, and the budget on this is bonkers and it's on screen. And as you know, as someone who watches so many low budget indies, I always am like drawn to like, oh, give me that opulence on screen. And like, there is a recreation shot from Viva Las Vegas of him like singing by the pool that's under 5 seconds and it has 100 extras. Like, it is so, I was like, the budget for this shot that they barely used I could make a whole motion picture for it. Like, there are so many things like that. There's so much in this movie. And it is this, Baz Luhrmann he's a rare artist in how he approaches things. He sees the minute it starts, like the minute you get any of those, oh, this is going to be one of those zoom follow through shots. It's going to go up 30 feet into the air and then come and land on the nail of this pin or whatever. Like all of these, it's very him. No one else can do it. And I have a real soft spot for directors who are like, I have a way of speaking cinematically, and it's in every part of it. It's in wardrobe, it's in sound design, it's in cinematography. Like there's no watching any part of this movie and wondering who made it.
Yeah, this is Baz Luhrmann's Elvis in the same way that The Music Lovers is Ken Russell's Tchaikovsky. Like no one comes away thinking like, ah, yes, I've just read the Cliff Notes and learned a history lesson. No, you've seen a very specific version of an acclaimed life through the very specific lens of this one crackpot filmmaker who makes everything, you know, his version of it.
But I wish we kind of got to see more of that, because like I'm probably more of a Catherine Martin fan than I am of a Baz fan. And there's just so much incredible craft and so much incredible technical work in this film. Even Austin Butler's performance, like I only knew him as like the fifth best elf from Shannara Chronicles, right? I was like, is this the guy? But there were facets to it that were really interesting and things that I wanted to see and sit with. But it was so frantic, the whole film. Everything, like the cuts and the movement and everything. I just wanted to be like, oh my God, can we just slow down for 5 seconds so I can actually appreciate the opulence and appreciate the work and appreciate the craft? It kept reminding me of, you know, in Taken 3, that famous scene where Liam Neeson goes to jump the fence and they do like 120 cuts of like a 6 second. That's what it kept reminding me of. And I'm like, let me just see the old bastard jump the fence. Like, I just wanted to sit with it.
That's part of the budget I'm talking about. Like, to be able to edit this, and I thought the editing was fantastic. It is frenetic, but that is his style. Like, once you're into it, you're into it. But you cannot have an edit like this if you haven't captured every scene from 1,000 different angles. Like, there's no coverage in this movie. It's, we shot it from here. We shot it from here. We like.
Baz Luhrmann has a formula, and that's the only formula I'll choose over breast milk, because I'll drink it right up. I've latched on to Baz at an early age, from Romeo and Juliet down to Moulin Rouge. So I just am a fan of it. All those car scenes made me wish he would do a Fast and Furious movie, because he just, like, you just felt so fucking cool when you would just see him and his posse in the car just driving down, like, old Hollywood. I agree with you, Dre. I think, like, the frenetic nature of it kind of complimented the story being told of, like, this was a lot of shit being thrown at this person. Like, he comes back from the military, he's back to being in Hollywood, now everyone's throwing their panties at him, now he's and it felt like it got really, like, just all over the place, and then it stopped in that Christmas moment, which, like, it wasn't perfect, because I was like, my mans was sitting here watching, you know, the outcome of the MLK assassination, which, like, led to the funeral, and also his weird colonel managers pitching him this thing. I was like, this all happened right now, right here on this lot. All right, Boz, you crazy for this one. But I did like that it just felt like it, everything that was, like, zooming felt, went to a halt, and that was a point where his career went to a halt. And then we have him sitting in the shitty Hollywood land sign, and he goes back to his roots, and we see this next levels. And that, actually, I'm going to use that to talk about, like, my Elvis experience. My Elvis experience is, same thing. Like, late in his years, fat Elvis. Like, first Elvis reference for me was Don't Be a Menace in South Central, when they did the Stand By Me bit, where they was like, want to see a dead body, and it's like a fat Elvis on the train tracks, and he's like farting. Like that was the legacy, which, like, Alonzo
just died. R.I.P. Yeah. Alonzo, we miss you.
Yeah, that was the legacy that was, like, given to my generation. Was like, oh, this guy, and the whole he died on a toilet thing. Right. But luckily for me, you know, as I've said, when I went to Cleveland, I went to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and they had a huge Elvis exhibit, and I actually took some time there, because one, I knew I was going to see the movie, and two, it was, like, very interesting, because you know how all these, like, museums will have these, like, rolling kind of docu films, mm-hmm, that everyone, yeah,
installations,
that installations that most people are just moving past. They're kind of taking the pieces that they can and move past, and that's how it was all over the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, except for the Elvis exhibit, where you just had both rows filled with these women who were, like, in their heyday, in his heyday, and they were just, like, eyes glued, and I was like, okay, he still got it. He still got it. But, like, there were also some elements I learned about Elvis that you know, I feel like we didn't get seen. And I get why, because we're focusing on the Colonel, which was Tom Hanks, which I did not figure out till about the International Hotel.
Stop it!
Wow. The International Hotel is like, this guy feels familiar. And I pulled out my little phone.
You never change, you sweet little baby.
And I was like, oh, that's my boy Tom Hanks. If anything, that is a credit to our boy T. Hanks, and how transformative he was in this performance.
Whereas I'm thinking, I know that it's a credit to someone else than just total embarrassment to you.
I was thinking, if you ever want to know what it would be like if the 1966 Batman TV show had Tom Hanks on as a villain.
That said, I heard before I went in, two things: that Austin Butler was fantastic, which he is, and absolutely, I would be very happy to discuss that in detail.
Oh,
he
yes,
was phenomenal in this, and this is such an undertaking. And yeah, I mean, just kudos to him. But I also heard so much about how Tom Hanks was just terrible, and then it started, and I was like, yeah, I don't have these people never seen a Baz Luhrmann film? Like, do you not know what the villains sound like? Like, they have lisps, or they have, like, weird stuff. Like, yeah, what did you think this guy was going to do? This, anyway, he was, it made total sense to me. I was very calibrated in on, yeah, I get this. I get your weird accent. I would honestly have rather had a whole thing of people railing about him in a fat suit in the same way they do whenever you cast women in fat suits than I would his ridiculous performance, because of course it was ridiculous. It's Elvis by Baz Luhrmann.
But there's like, you know, trying to fit a look, and then there is just the like grotesque. Like, I felt like at some moments I was like, I feel like we're putting a little too much sauce. And now looking at pictures of Tom Parker, I'm like, yeah, no, there's definitely too much sauce. We were drowning in the sauce. This is spaghetti sauce on the pasta versus in the pasta. When it comes,
they turn him into Orson Welles in Touch of Evil, basically.
Yeah. But again, like for the movie part of it, that fit for me. Because it's also, I'm a gambler. I'm using Elvis for money. I'm sure all of these things were rooted in some kind of truths. But for the bombastic nature of what we're looking at, and you're also setting up a world where Elvis, a serial adulterer, like all of these things, is like that is just like blithely brushed aside by his saintly, gorgeous child bride.
Well, who's still alive and holds the key to the vault of all this stuff. I think it's important.
And she signed off on this. She was at the Cannes premiere. Like
they all were. The whole estate has been on the press tail.
And it's not even just that she signed off on it. She, I'm sure, had like a lot of approval of everything from the jump, because she has, her role in life for the last several decades has been the keeper of this particular flame. So anything that Baz wanted to include or exclude from this movie, I'm sure had to be approved by her.
Tom Hanks is playing a cartoonish villain because he's in a cartoon. Like everything that Baz's work is essentially live action animation for all intents and purposes.
But the thing is, like Austin Butler, to me, does that thing that I love when people do in biopics, where I just felt like after a while I was seeing Elvis. And by the end of the movie, they're intercutting him in a performance with actual Elvis, and it's seamless. Whereas like Tom Hanks, I never stopped thinking, Tom Hanks in a skinhead wig, like what's going on here?
He disappeared into the role for Iffy. So
clearly, when you throw all that makeup on one Tom Hanks, you really get lost in it.
But he got all the makeup.
Yeah. But I will say that is a great point. There was a point at the end when they were intercutting between him and the footage where I couldn't tell.
Yeah.
And that's when I was like, y'all did it. It's like,
so the Austin Butler of it. So this is, like Maria said, someone who's been around in a few things. Some of us
know him as Disney kid. He's been around forever. Yeah.
He was Vanessa Hudgens' boyfriend for years, which is how some of us know him.
But you can see it on the press tour, because the way anybody that comes out of the Disney school, the Disney training camp, the way they approach press and media and the answers and the responses are very specific and universal in a way. I was trying to think of other famous Elvis, biopics, right? And versions of this that have even been okay or close to good. And there haven't really been any. And the nearest one that I could think of was like the last time I saw someone play Elvis, it was Jonathan Rhys-Meyers in this TV movie that had Rose McGowan in it. And Randy Quaid was playing Colonel Tom Parker. And I was like, wow, this is a different tier. And the transformational aspect to it really like elevates the material in a way that you just, for better or worse, you're getting like pulled into this world and there's no escape until you're at hour 2:34,
Yeah. Even just from the still images, you're so critical. You know Elvis's face so well. Even if you know him or not, you're like, yeah, I know that face. It's been around forever. It's probably on a stamp. But he has the sort of like surprised sexuality of like, oh, what? I'm so much hotter than I thought I was. Like, there's so much of him. He's giving so much. His performance, as his singing is spot on. But even his comfort, like, Elvis gets to, like, you look at your 10,000 hours of perfecting. That man had so many performances. Maybe it is the Nickelodeon days that really paid off. But I was genuinely so thrilled to see what he did with this, because he put his whole self into it, and to have someone do that and have it be rewarding is great. I always like to see people succeed, you guys. You know this about me, and I think he succeeded.
I would put this up there with Chadwick Boseman's performance in Get On Up in terms of like an actor taking on this like iconic rock presence, and really, because, you know, we've seen some less successful versions of that in the last few years, because this has become the movie everybody wants to make now, you know, in pursuit of awards love. But this was one of those performances I was like, you know, I'm not even, who are you? You have summoned the ghost of Elvis, and you're just, he's back, and you're doing 50s Elvis and you're doing 70s Elvis. And, you know, like I've rewatched the 68 special after watching this movie, and I'm like, God, he's nailing all this stuff.
You're right. He just knocks it out of the park. And I think it's one of those things that you kind of hope for in a movie where like this performance is so good. It kind of just like floats everything up for me. And it's why, you know, I walked away really liking this movie and enjoying it. And I think it does help to be someone who's like, I'm liking the Baz Luhrmann sauce. I like the shiny. I like the sparkling. I like the, it was just like, you know, like when the Wachowskis did speed racers, and they, it's like, yeah, go ahead. Saturation up, sparkle, lens flare. Let's push it to the limit. And I think, especially because, you know, the old Hollywood of it all, you know, like I love this, like, you know, there's that, you know, that perceived glamour to it. Right. And just like, I just felt it.
Boat.
I'm a screen it for sure. I think you really just want the full big screen wash over you experience, because Baz Luhrmann demands it, you know? And so if you go in knowing that you are getting not Elvis, but Baz Luhrmann's Elvis, then absolutely, you know, I think you're gonna have a great time. It is all the things that it is aspiring to be, pretty much. And I'll say this, you know, Elvis never did anything as bad to, you know, his visionary black rock and roll contemporaries as Pat Boone did when he covered Tutti Frutti.
Yeah, I'll go. Also a screen it.
Ooh.
Loved this so much. And I knew within a few seconds that I was going to love it. And which is great, because it's a long ass movie. So if I'd known in the seconds I was going to hate it, I would have been real bummed. Yes, Maria mentioned Baz Luhrmann being OTT, and although she means over the top and she was correct, I did have a momentary pause of other titles, Trivets? How does that work? But yeah, it's over the top and grandiose, and there's so much happening, and there's so much movie here, but there's also real joy. It is soulful and exciting, and even if it's messy or whatever, it's movie making from the heart. It's, you know, biting off a whole chunk and digging into it. And I really enjoyed it. There's also such great music throughout, like Calvin Harrison Jr., shout out to a little Sundance baby, played B.B. King. Gary Clark Jr. plays some blues musician I didn't know, but like you're having a nice, of course, it's Baz Luhrmann, so you're having contemporary music intermingled with the music of the time. And yeah, it's wonderful. A feast for the senses.
Yummy. Maria.
It's a stream it from me. I definitely saw it. It was beautiful. And I wish it had been a music video. For me personally, that would be a stream.
Just another Tuesday in Australia.
But I will say that, like, coming to that with the context of I'm not the biggest Baz Luhrmann fan. I haven't necessarily gone back and been like, hells yeah, man, let me rewatch Australia. That's what I want. Let me spend my time with that. Probably Strictly Ballroom is the rewatchable of his films for me. I haven't necessarily been a ride or die Baz head. I'm not his biggest fan, and that is probably, I think, what colors my experience with this, is I just want everything to just like chill the fuck out by like 6 degrees. That would be sick.
Well, I am a big Baz Luhrmann fan, so you know it's going to be a screen it in 4DX if you have to. If you're rumbling in the cars down the street with the Presley family, Presley Estates, just let it rip. Let it rip.
Elvis in 4D is haunting, because what is that? Like, are you getting the sweat splash in the third row? Like, are you getting the dustings of Coke?
You
like,
have to wear a poncho.
Dr. Nick is poking things into your arm the whole time.
Okay, well, I think this is a good time to take a quick break, but when we come back, we got some more show for you, so don't go anywhere, please. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Please, thank you.
Please, we beg.
Hey there, I'm Ellen Weatherford.
And I'm Christian Weatherford.
And we've got big feelings about animals that we just gotta share.
On Just the Zoo of Us, your new favorite animal review podcast, we're here to critically evaluate how each animal excels and how it doesn't, rating them out of 10 on their effectiveness, ingenuity, and aesthetics.
Guest experts give you their takes informed by actual, real-life experiences studying and working with very cool animals like sharks, cheetahs, and sea turtles.
It's a field trip to the zoo for your ears.
So if you or your kids have ever wondered if a pigeon can count, why sloths move so slow, or how a spider sees the world, find out with us every Wednesday on Just the Zoo of Us in its natural habitat on MaximumFun.org.
Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Maximum Film. I'm your host, Ivy Wadiway. In the studio with me are
Alonzo Duraldi,
Maria Lewis,
Drea Clark.
And we've got a fresh new hotline call for you today. Marissa, play that call.
Hi, all. I'm Jessica J. from Rhode Island, and I'm absolutely insufferable about historical costuming in film. I'm a part-time historical reenactor and self-taught seamstress. And because of both of those things, I tend to notice super quickly when there's any anachronistic details in period film dress. Things like actresses wearing corsets without chemises underneath, or whatever Pinterest-inspired messy bun with side-swept bangs Dakota Johnson is wearing in the recent Persuasion trailer. My question is, what weird fixation of yours completely took you out of an otherwise great film? It could be a bad accent from a place you actually lived, a 2000 soundtrack choice in a film set in the 90s, or any other instance where a film demonstrated ignorance about something you care way too much about to let slide. Love the show, and thanks for making my long hours of sewing less boring, thanks to your melodic voices and thoughtful insight.
Oh, good question, Jessica.
That was such a very good question.
Oh, I love that. She's so cute and sweet.
I have a good friend who couldn't get through the Greta Gerwig Little Women because, you know, the woolens were all wrong. So, you know, thankfully that is not my personal cross to bear, but I understand it's a thing that if you know, you know.
Yeah, it is interesting to me because this is the first time in a while that there's a hotline call that I'm just charged up with like picks for because of the nature of my dumbass nerdery, you know. Like I think right off the bat we're gonna start with something easy, softball, something y'all have heard me bring up on the show. But anytime there's an African accent that's supposed to be Nigerian, it is like because it just seems like we've gotten better at it because the first time it changed for me was even though it wasn't even like Nigerian specifically, but was when Winston Duke spoke in Black Panther, and I was like, oh, that's Igbo inspired. And they were like, yeah, we inspired it by Igbo. And I was like, yeah, this is why you can't do that, is because like it may seem like all African accents are kind of the same, but there is a very I know the difference between the Wakandan accents versus everything, even though like I did kind of cringe a little bit behind the description when they talked about it, because the Wakandan accent is very wispy, and it's like it's very much like this, like almost like you're starting to whisper but you don't because it's trying to get that. And so and I was reading up on it, and they were like, well, you know, because Wakandan's not conquered, we wanted to do an accent because, you know, it's the one place in Africa's not conquered. And I was like, there are unconquered parts of Africa, it's just the parts you're afraid to go to. Like, and also it's like it just felt very like dumb, like when it was like well, it's because it's not conquered. It was like, eat my ass, bro.
I do have in our friendship contract, if he's only allowed to speak to me in a Wakandan accent, if he telephones me, it's great. It's I recommend having friendship contracts just for that kind of reason.
I cannot tell you the number of Hallmark Christmas movies about magazines podcasts or just the media in general that gets stuff so howlingly wrong, starting with, you know, planning the big Christmas feature on, oh, December 22nd. you know, just like everything. And I'm sure, like, look, if you're a doctor or a lawyer, like, TV is nothing but a minefield of, like, what are you even talking about? You know, but it is, so it's rare that I even see things that even remotely deal with my silly career. But yeah, any of those things where they really try and portray somebody who is functioning in a media space and doing everything at the last minute and with the idea that, like, people are all at work or tuning in or buying a newspaper or whatever on Christmas Day and not, like, utterly tuned out and done with it by then, always cracks me up. This for me, it's more a movie that's already bad for a million other reasons is also committing these particular sins. Like, I remember there was a comedy called Take Me Home Tonight that is set in, I forget what specific year in 1980, but the soundtrack is set in the 1980s.
Yep.
Before, after, during, all mooshed together. And also movies about the 80s tend to do this thing that drives Dave and me crazy, which is like frat guys in 1982 dancing to New Order. No. New Order was like, you had to be a very specific kind of, like, you know, alternative college radio, you know, freak, basically, to be paying attention to that stuff. And the cool kids didn't pick up on it until much later.
So mine, I think I actually might have mentioned in a recent movie we discussed. As you guys know, I worked at a summer camp, YMCA, Camp St. Croix, Hudson, Wisconsin, for 7 years. And I led canoeing trips, but also I taught a lot of sailing and ended up being the sailing director. So in general, if there's anything camping related or people building a fire or whatever, I'm always like, ugh, I call bullshit, or don't pick your canoe up by the gunwale. Oh my God. Like, but sailing, forget it. So when we watch Top Gun Maverick, there's this whole, and I loved the impetus for it because it's Jennifer Connelly getting to show she's just as skilled and just as passionate, just as adventurous as Maverick. And they have her on this monohull and she is standing in like a wide, in the Chris Pratt Christian lunge, like across this boat. And so she's on a beam reach, which is the fastest point of sail, except for her sail is so improperly trimmed. It's pulled all the way in. And so the whole time I was like, it's bad sailing that you're doing this. Like, either take a reef or sheet out or head into the wind a little, you're killing me. And then they have the audacity of having Maverick run up a spinnaker and they're headed into the wind. Okay, put up a spinnaker. Anyway, this is why people won't see movies that have sailing in them with me, because I turn
Hollywood hired Greya as your sailing consultant. You're doing it all wrong.
You would have been insufferable to watch Double Jeopardy with. You would have been like, you can never kill somebody on their boat like that. What are you talking about, Ashley Judd?
There's a sailing scene in Sleeping with the Enemy, and I'm like, I'm not gonna get into this. Are you kidding me? First off, okay, she's gonna go off the leeward side. Okay, it's not
never
fun.
Watched
it's
it.
Not a cute trait of mine.
But mine is also water based. My two are water based. First one is
that's what I've heard. Sorry, that was just sitting there. I couldn't let it go.
My two are very wet. Okay, no, first one is Top of the Lake with, quote-unquote, our generation's Meryl Streep, Elizabeth Moss, who does the worst Australian/New Zealand accent. If you haven't watched the first season of that show, you're missing out. It's a really great show, Jane Campion series, set in South Island. Holly Hunter giving one of the most, like, wildest, unhinged, and specific performances I've ever seen. It's truly incredible. But Elizabeth Moss's accent is just unlistenable in many ways. If you're like, is she Australian or New Zealand? And they're like, what about both? And I'm like, what about crushing neither? And then the other one is a film that I love in spite of this, and it's Blue Crush, which is a seminal movie, I think, for any woman who grew up surfing. And like, I was on the junior surfing circuit, so I was like, oh my God, this is our film, right? And I loved the idea that it was, you know, three women of different ethnicities from a lower socioeconomic background trying to make it in this, like, male-dominated sport where the stakes are so high. If you like, if it's a football film, the stakes are, you know, you lose or whatever, you get kicked off the team. In surfing, the stakes are, yeah, you could lose or not make it through the next round, but you can also die. And the big scenes, the stuff that was shot at Pipe, was perfectly well done, as well as it could be done for 2002, right? They use like a facial replacement technology. They put like Kate Bosworth's face on the other surfer. I think it's Lane Beachley, actually, who was kind of like the seminal big wave surfer of that time. And that hasn't aged well, but like whatever. I'm not throwing Kate Bosworth into a 20-foot wave at Pipe, but that's just me. But it's all the stuff in between where they have these shots where it's like they're playing Cruel Summer. So it's like, it's a cruel, cruel, cruel summer. And like all the girls are like having a sick time, like surfing. And so it does this thing where it's, they'll have the actors surfing along a wave and then they'll cut away and have a reaction shot of someone else. So it's like a dog riding a mall or something. And then they cut back to the girls and they're not only on a completely different wave, but riding in a different direction to it, which is always one of those things where it's just like, this is so frustrating because whatever direction you ride on the wave, it's closing behind you, right? So you can't just like change your mind and be like, oh, well, I'll just head right. And so do a hard pivot and ride into a closed wave. It's such a small thing and like such a tiny little detail, but it always just like irked my gherkin. And yeah, I don't know. The question was so interesting because I liked that it was from a historical perspective.
Yeah.
Very interesting. The curtain bangs mentioned and the upcoming Dakota Johnson Persuasion is really interesting because I do love that book and I'm really excited to see what they did with it. Those are my contributions.
I just want to say thank Jessica for that. And also I hope that she gets her hands on or her eyeballs on The Great British Sewing Bee. I think you would like that show so much. I have to watch it on the BBC via a VPN. But it sounds from all your seamstressing, you might like that. Personal movie program or TV programming for our listener, Jessica J.
Yeah, you got a personal staff pick. So get your eyeballs on that. If you got a question for the hotline, make sure you record a voice memo and send it to MaximumFilm@MaximumFun.org. And now it's time for staff picks. It could be any movie at all. So who wants to start?
I'll go. So, yeah, it's been a real rough week in terms of American everything. And the movie I'd like to have people see is something, a documentary that premiered at Sundance this year, a film festival I might have mentioned before, but it's called The Janes. It's currently on HBO Max and I believe Hulu. It is about the Jane Collective from the 60s that set up a sort of abortion rights and abortion access and connectivity.
Network.
Thank you. That's the word I was looking for. Organization. Network. When abortion was highly illegal and doing a lot of damage. And there's something about these women that I am gleaning inspiration from right now in these current days, as frustrated as I am of looking at it as a current event rather than just a historical function. But it's well made. They got a lot of the women who were part of the Janes to be part of it and speaking up. So anyway, it's a great documentary. I highly recommend it, The Janes.
In honor of our question this week and of our guest, I'm going to recommend a documentary from 2015 called Women He's Undressed, which is the great Gillian Armstrong's film about the great Ori Kelly, who was an unapologetically queer fashion designer who came to Hollywood in the 30s and wound up like dressing Ingrid Bergman in Casablanca and Marilyn Monroe in Gentlemen for Blondes and a lot of just a really sort of iconic legend. Marilyn Monroe in some like it hot rather. It was some really iconic screen looks and, you know, had to cope with the fact that, you know, his ex-boyfriend, Cary Grant was not so nice to him once Cary started marrying women and became a big movie star while Ori Kelly was still very frankly queer in a town that was not super embracing of that all the time. But anyway, and wouldn't you know it, it's on Canopy and Tubi.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is, Alonzo.
Big old Tubi.
There's a really great accompanying coffee table book as well that I would highly recommend. Ooh.
Maria, do you have a movie?
Yes, So my staff pick slash recommendation is a film that I don't know. Is it maybe going to soothe you in these times? That's kind of not Alex Garland's bag, but it's Men, which is his new film. It stars Jesse Buckley and Rory Kinnear. And I emphasis there on the Rory Kinnear stuff because he plays like, I think, 15 different characters.
In the title role.
It's wild. I love Penny Dreadful. And that was the first time I had seen him in anything on screen. And, you know, he's a really acclaimed, obviously, stage actor. But and he was so great in that show playing Frankenstein's monster and also the devil intermittently. What range? But in this, it's basically his face, you know, wigs and costumes and prosthetics, but also his face, you know, superimposed onto a child's body. It follows this woman, Jessie Buckley, who, following a tragedy in her personal life, goes to a small town to try and sort of deal with it and her emotions and her grief. And every single man, every single person in that town is a man, and it's every single person is played by Rory Kinnear. And it's very weird, as most Alex Garland films are. If you've seen Ex Machina, if you've seen Annihilation, specifically those two, I think, are probably the most relevant to this discussion. His work with Danny Boyle is equally like weird in ways, but also much more mainstream. And this is just a really fascinating kind of, I don't know, almost like spiritual slash supernatural thriller that has insane body horror elements to it. There are things in this movie that I have never seen on screen before and never thought I would see on screen. And it's just something I've been thinking about for days. I have not been able to stop ruminating on this film, which is like such a Garland thing. And yeah, it's really interesting. It's really horrifying. And it has really just sat with me in the way that, you know, a lot of his stuff does.
Iffy.
What you got, Iffy?
Well, after watching, you know, Tom Hanks do a performance, you know, really pulling out all the stops when it comes to being transformative, using great accents, I feel like the choice for my staff pick based on Tom Hanks was an obvious one. Out of his, you know, oeuvre of films and performances of cinema that he's taken parts in, there's one choice that
if you
that
say the movie, I think you're going to say, "Oh God, lose
what
my mind."
You, if you say it,
no, I'm literally so stressed right now.
I know. I'm so curious to what y'all think I might say, but I'm going to say, of course, it is none other than 2004, The Lady Killers.
That's exactly what I was thinking. I was like, but, no, he's not.
Yeah,
no,
you
he's
know,
not.
Just another, just bringing some more Southern charm to your screens, straight from the minds of the Coens. You know, a movie so good it scared them from casting black people for a while, but now,
why drink not that see in. Tom Hanks's two worst performances back to back?
You're going to say The Terminal because he's got a really unhinged accent in that.
Yeah. It's all, good, it's, good call. True.
Oh, wow. Well, that, yeah, I'm glad that ended with a bang, and I'm glad y'all felt that coming. Maria Lewis, thank you for joining us.
It's so nice to have me back. It's so nice to be here.
Yeah, we'll have to get you back sooner. I love talking with you.
Please don't. I'm a vampire. You can't rescind that invitation now. I'm in the fucking
yeah,
house.
Yeah, no, it's that. No, it's always a blast to have you here. Is there anything you'd like to plug and let people know where they can find you?
You can find me online. I'm on Instagram and Twitter, Maria Lewis, just search me and I'll pop up. My eighth book, Her Fierce Creatures, is out at the moment, which you can check out if you like feminist monster stories. It seems kind of topical at the moment, she says while sobbing. And also I have an audio documentary called The Phantom Never Dies, which if you want to learn about the pop culture etymology of superheroes and the very first superhero, a guy in a purple suit called The Phantom, then you can find that however you would listen to podcasts.
The Ghost Who Walks.
Yay!
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, man. Ooh. Dre and Alonzo, as always, thank you for being here with me. It's going to be a blast as we do this for a million years. If you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, tweet at us at @maximum_film. Our Facebook group can be found at www.facebook.com/groups/maximumfilm, or send us an email at maximumfilm@maximumfun.org. And that's also where you can send those hotline calls. Our super producer is Marissa Flaxbart. Our super senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of Maximum Fun.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.